and a song to sing. I got a song to sing. It keeps me out of the cold. And I'll meet you further on up the road. Further on up the road. Further on up the road. Where the way is dark and the night is cold. One sunny morning we'll rise, I know. And I'll meet you farther on up the road. Now I've been out in the desert, just doing my time, searching through the dust, looking for a sign. If there's a light up ahead, well, brother, I don't know. But I got this fever burning in my soul. Further on up the road. 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 One sunny morning we'll rise, I know. And I'll meet you further on up the road.
And we're back up.
Hey, you're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut. We're streaming at WPKN.org. And this is Ken McDermott Rowe and Gus Candavero filling in for Scott Harris, host of Counterpoint. And we have our next guest coming up.
We
Rick
do.
Rick Rosoff.
Rick, are you there?
Yes, I am. And thanks for the invitation.
Oh, thanks for joining us, Rick. This is Ken. Our guest, Rick Rosoff, is a Chicago-based geopolitical analyst. Many of Rick's articles on global military strategy are published in the think tank by the think tank Global Research. Rick is also the founder and manager of the international email news list Stop NATO, which critically examines NATO's worldwide expansion. And thank you so much for being with us tonight, Rick.
I'm very pleased to be on. Thank you for asking me.
Our listeners are, of course, very aware of the U.S.-led wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But what I learned from reading your articles is that these wars are just two components of an expanding U.S. global military presence. Could you talk about the U.S. global military strategy and in particular the role being played by this transformed NATO?
That's a very important question, and we could go on for hours, but I'll try to be as concise as I can on this, unfortunately. I mean, I wish it was far more limited. We have to, I think, situate everything within the context of the last 20 years, which is not only the end of the Cold War, but the end of any military power that could seriously present a challenge or even an obstacle to global U.S. Military designs. I'm talking about the formal dissolution of the Warsaw Pact and the fragmentation of the Soviet Union in the same year, in 1991, which was also, of course, the year of Operation Desert Storm, which in many ways was the opening salvo, I think, in the United States announcing itself as the uncontested global military superpower. I don't know how many of your listeners read our current president's Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech last December, for example. One will appreciate the irony given the venue and the occasion, but he quite avowedly, unabashedly rather, identified his country, our country, as the world's sole military superpower. That's a quote. And, there was no...
Don't be shy.
Yeah, exactly. No hesitancy, no shyness about that. He was quite, thumping his chest, and then at the same time, bemoaning the fact that other countries resent that fact, right? You know, that
how
they're
dare
villains for resenting our uncontested global military dominance.
Don't they know we're here for their protection?
Well, now, NATO is a North Atlantic Treaty Organization, right? Uh-huh. What does it have to do with places like Afghanistan?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. I just wrote a recent article, and I talk about the integration of Pakistan into NATO's global military network, in addition to, you know, Afghanistan, which is a little better than a military colony of NATO right now. By the way, that's NATO's first Asian war. It's his first. It's NATO's first ground war, something it never fought during you know, almost half a century of the Cold War, but it's fighting now, and there's. Initially, under UN auspices, there was something set up called International Security Assistance Force, ISAF, which very quickly came under NATO control. And currently, there are officially 46 nations contributing troops to NATO command and for the war in Afghanistan and adjoining countries. I mean, we have to realize, you know, the war is spread across the Durand Line into Pakistan. In addition to those 46 countries, there are a good half dozen more who have troops there but are not formally troop-contributing nations, as NATO puts it. So, you know, for the first time in human history, a military bloc has troops from over 50 nations serving not only in one war theater, but in one nation.
What was the legal hook that the United States got NATO involved in Afghanistan?
Well, yeah, I'm glad you asked that. Article 5 of the NATO founding document is basically a military mutual support or self-defense or mutual defense, I guess would be the polite euphemism for it. But it obligates every member of NATO and presumably a good number of their partners to enter the list or to take up cudgels in defense of any other member that is under military assault. And I think it was understood that, you know, during the Cold War years, as being if a NATO member was militarily attacked. When September the 11th occurred in 2001, NATO for the first time and to date invoked its Article 5 for two purposes. First of all, for all other NATO members to assist the U.S. war in South Asia and Afghanistan, but also to set up something called Operation Active Endeavor, which started immediately after 9/11, is continuing and presumably will continue for the into the indefinite future. It is a comprehensive maritime naval surveillance and interdiction operation throughout the Mediterranean. NATO brags, for example, of, to use their own term, hailing 100,000 ships. You know, in that interim between 2001 and now. NATO, for the first time, also has a long-term, again, permanent, presumably, naval operation in the Horn of Africa area, in the Gulf of Aden, and into the Indian Ocean. It's called Operation Ocean Shield. And earlier this year, they announced they were extending it to December of 2012. That is for another 3 years. So the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, you know, has now expanded from 12 members, most of whom did have shorelines on the Atlantic Ocean, to 28, most of whom don't. They have military partnerships with, you know, comfortably, you know, another 30, 40 nations all over the world.
I think you mentioned over about a third of the UN now is either in NATO or has some kind of an agreement with NATO.
Yeah, actually, I think probably more than that. If there are 192 nations in the United Nations, you know, close to 70 have military partnerships with NATO or are among the 28, you know, full member states of the bloc. And these include countries in Africa, in the Middle East, the Persian Gulf, South Pacific, Asia. Colombia is offering several hundred troops for NATO in Afghanistan, which would situate in South America. That would mean that NATO had some kind of partnership with countries on every inhabited continent. As a matter of fact, there was a statement in 2006 by Kurt Volker, who had worked for the State Department. And after he made the statement, he would end up being U.S. permanent representative to NATO, ambassador to NATO. And he was bragging in 2006, and I'll quote him, that NATO was engaged in 8 simultaneous operations on 4 continents in 2005, those 4 continents being Europe, Africa, Asia, and with Katrina, New Orleans, North America.
The United States seems to parallel NATO in that it's divided the world up into these global military commands. Could you talk about them?
Yeah, that's another important point I'm glad you've raised. You know, the United States is alone, currently and in history, in having the number of what they call unified combatant commands, but in essence, 6 of them are major regional commands that take in the entire globe. some of them were created after World War II, like European Command, Pacific Command. One was formed in 1983 by the Reagan administration, Central Command, which, of course, we know with David Petraeus taking over Stanley McChrystal in the Afghan War Theater. That Central Command includes Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, in other words, the major active war zones currently. And that had been the most recent, 1983, until after 2001 again, where the U.S. created a North Atlantic or North American Military Command, NORTHCOM. But more particularly, I think your readers or your listeners rather are aware that formally in October 1st, 2007, but launched in earnest a year later, in 2008, was Africa Command, AFRICOM.
AFRICOM.
Which is takes an entire continent, 53 nations, and the second most populous continent in the world. You know, it's just been arbitrarily assigned to a U.S. military command.
And you mentioned that we have partnerships with 35 African nations. I don't think the American people have any idea that we have these involvements.
American people can't name 35 African nations.
That's terrible, but I'm afraid it's probably true. As a matter of fact, that quote is from General William Ward, who's the commander of AFRICOM, and it's outdated, I think, conservatively, of the 53 nations. It depends on how you count these, by the way. You know, Western Sahara is recognized by most African nations and is a member of the African Union, but is not recognized by the United States and its NATO allies because Morocco seized it in 1975, and Morocco is a military client state of the United States and is a partner of NATO, incidentally, in the Mediterranean dialogue. But if there are 53 nations, and Egypt alone is not in AFRICOM, it remains in Central Command.
And we also have an important command in Djibouti, right?
Yeah, that's the only permanent large-scale U.S. military base in the African continent to date. It certainly won't be the last. There are estimates from 2,500 to 3,000 U.S. troops. They've been stationed there since 2002. The U.S. has it's an old French Legionnaire base. It's called Camp Le Manier.
And this is in the Horn of Africa? This is kind of
it's very strategic. It's exactly where the Red Sea meets the Gulf of Aden going into the Indian Ocean. It's an immediate striking distance from and has been used to strike targets both inside Somalia and Yemen, you know, on both sides, both in Africa and the Saudi Peninsula.
So you mentioned Somalia and Yemen. I don't think most people are very aware of what's going on there. But there's fighting going on there. What involvement does NATO or the United States have in Yemen and Somalia?
Well, the United States, I think, fairly directly. I mean, we acknowledge having launched drone missile strikes inside Yemen. We've done the same, and we have ground operations, you know, covert operations, commando operations inside Somalia. Pardon me, but there have been a number of stories just within the last week that the U.S. is going to step up its support for what's called AMISOM. It's an African Union, in theory, an African Union military deployment to Somalia. It, in fact, consists overwhelmingly of troops from Uganda, Burundi, and Rwanda, which are U.S. military client states. And there was an article in the East African, a major newspaper in Uganda, just last week that hinted that Uganda, which is a U.S. military proxy, is prepared to invade Somalia with 20,000 troops. This is about the same time the U.S. announces it's going to provide more support. NATO is also supporting airlift into Somalia, as it did into Darfur 5 years ago, and expanding its operations on the African continent in addition to off the coast of the Horn of Africa.
Now, why are we in Somalia? What's wrong with this? Is it the Al-Shabaab group that's resisting NATO and the United States? What is our problem with them?
We're propping up a government called Transitional, I guess Transitional Forever, Permanent Transitional Federal Government in Mogadishu, in the capital. And, by universal accord, this regime has very little support, even in the capital, certainly none outside.
It's transitional until it gets overthrown again.
Right, until the next transitional government succeeds it, you know. The standard accusation since 9/11/01, of course, anytime we want to intervene somewhere, we accuse rebel groups or militia groups of having contacts with al-Qaeda. And that seems to
be the magic word.
Yeah, exactly. But, starting last December, another U.S. military ally and proxy, Saudi Arabia, got involved directly in fighting in northern Yemen, against a minority community called Houthis or Houthis. They're a variation of Shia Muslim. There's no indication, being Shia, that they would have any, connection with Al-Qaeda, of course, quite the opposite.
Right, they're the enemies, aren't they?
But Saudi Arabia launched just blistering, jet fighter attacks and artillery attacks, killed, maybe several hundred civilians. The U.S. was accused by the Houthi community as being involved in that attack. And this, of course, is long before the Christmas Day, or weeks before the Christmas Day airplane bomb scare outside of Detroit, which was then used, as the excuse for intervening further in Yemen.
Uh-huh. What is the fear? Is that these Shiites in Yemen, if they take power, will form an alliance with Iran?
I've been told that the particular brand of Shiism is not one that is at all close to the dominant version in Iran, and that probably is not the case, whereas, that's been used for Lebanon or Iraq. I don't think it's really applicable to Yemen. But you also have, mass resistance to the government in the south, which is not only secular but traditionally left. It's a remnant, so I think they still call themselves Socialist Party of Yemen, which appears to be the major opposition group in the south of the country. And, of course, starting last December when the Obama administration authorized military strikes inside the southern part of Yemen, the accusation, of course, was Al-Qaeda.
You've written about the use of drones. Are they being used in Yemen or Somalia?
Yeah, they've been used in both. They've been used, of course, in Iraq, during some of the bigger offensive years since the invasion. And in Afghanistan, but of course most devastatingly and most lethally in Pakistan, where their estimates had well in excess of 1,000 people have been killed in less than 2 years. This was started in the waning days of the Bush administration, August 2008, and it's escalating constantly. As a matter of fact, I think just yesterday there was a headline in some of the wire services that 28 people were killed in one day.
Hey, Rick, I have a question. This is Gus.
Gus.
When just a moment ago you were talking about the Shia administration of Yemen and how they're not the same types that rule in Iran. For the casual observer, it is just impossible because, we aren't really raised with the kind of religious awareness and tolerance in this country of knowing who around the world believes what, and I think just like the average person just refers to everyone in the Middle East as an Arab.
Mm-hmm.
Is the administration or the leadership in Yemen, are they softliners or are they hardliners compared to like an Iranian administration?
Well, actually, the political leadership in Yemen are Sunni, by their own personal background.
Okay.
The Houthi Shia minority in the north that's come under attack. As a matter of fact, there's been a resumption of fighting just within the last week after a peace treaty had brought about a relative period of quiet and peace. They're a secular government but culturally and historically an Islamic country, majority Sunni.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in this case, rather than dwelling on some of the confessional or ethnic and other differences in the country, though I do believe our nation hires people who know precisely how to exploit those differences whenever it's to their advantage.
For example, in Iraq, the people that we just backed to put in charge are hardliners in comparison to the previous administration, which had more religious tolerance, as far as I understand it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think one of my best friends is from Afghanistan, and he fled his country as his whole family did after our clients took over in 1992. I think people have to realize, what the war on terror, so-called global war on terror, renamed overseas contingency operations, is really about. Stanley McChrystal, before he stepped down as commander of all U.S. and NATO troops in Afghanistan, last August, September, released what was called the COMISAF, Commander International Security Assistance Force, report that was used as the justification for the latest U.S. buildup there. And he identified three groups that the U.S. was fighting.
Okay.
And one of them is a Taliban group based in Balochistan in Pakistan. And the other two are the groups of Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and Jalaluddin Haqqani, who were both U.S. clients. Throughout the 1980s, they were the major recipients of U.S. arms.
Mm-hmm.
and funds, you know, against the secular government of Afghanistan at that time. And, you know, now they've become our adversaries. And, you know, as a matter of fact, Charlie Wilson, who passed away earlier this year, you know, your listeners may know about the movie, referred to Haqqani as goodness personified during that, you know, the Mujahideen War in the 1980s. Right. So, you know, it's disingenuous to say the least.
Right. The point you just made about former friends and now, you know, an enemy, that's what we're going through with both potential wars with Korea and Iran. We gave nuclear weapons to Korea. Now they threaten to use them against us. And Iran, we overthrew the democratically elected government to put back in what we're dealing with now. And if we had played ball, you know, 10 years ago with the softline regime, we could have been friends with them. But instead now, by our actions and our you know, trying to honcho around the region and just, you know, rattle the cage, it seems like we've created a much bigger problem.
Well, who was the global alliance we put together? Who was it directed against? There are some big countries that are not in this alliance. Who are they?
You know, that's a good question. Whether we need a certain amount of outsiders we can use as a justification for regional military buildups, that, you know, that's my contention. I believe that's really true.
And what about Russia, China, and Iran?
Well, Russia and China, I mean, almost every report that comes out from any branch of the U.S. service or, you know, about potential rivals, you know, Russia and China are right up there, usually ahead of Al-Qaeda. And then, you know, North Korea, Venezuela, Iran, say, are, you know, the regional countries that, you know, we use to arm their neighbors and build up military networks surrounding them. You know, I wonder if every government of the world tomorrow capitulated and came over and told the U.S. it could have everything it wanted, if we wouldn't be in a panic.
What do we want? Is it about oil and gas? Is it about controlling major sea routes? What's the objective of this exercise?
I think you've mentioned some of the major ones. One has to assume, or, you know, the global objectives. As a matter of fact, last autumn, there's going to be a NATO summit in Lisbon, Portugal, in November, and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which again is now 28 members, you know, maybe 40 partners, over 40 partners, is going to formally endorse what they call their strategic concept. The last one adopted was in 1999, and there have been a number of meetings held around the world to kind of tout, you know, the new strategic concept. And one of them was held in London last autumn, and it was hosted by Lord Levine of Lloyd's of London. Honest to God, it was co-hosted by Lloyd's of London, the insurance company, which was very concerned about, you know, shipping lanes and shipping routes and
sure.
so forth, because they don't want to pay out on claims, I suspect. So it's becoming, you know, as a matter of fact, Hans von Sponeck, who was the UN humanitarian coordinator for Iraq.
That name rolls right off the tongue.
Yeah, and, you know, wrote an intriguing article in February of last year in a Swiss newspaper, and the title of the article is The United Nations and NATO. And in a section called 21st Century NATO Incompatible with the United Nations Charter, how's that for former UN Assistant Secretary General, you know, actually mentioned that one of the purposes of the expansion of NATO globally was, in his quote, you know, protection of the vital resources, end quote, needs of its members. And
it does sound like colonialism to me.
Yeah, it sounds like global, you know, domination of not only resources, but their transportation, their availability, and so forth, you know.
We were talking about regional alliances for specific purposes, and Asia is certainly a center of interest, too. I understand that there are exercises going on, even military exercises going on, even as we speak, that are China perceives as a threat. Could you talk about those?
Yeah, and, you know, with the alleged, in alleged response to, you know, the sinking in March of a South Korean corvette, Shonan. And the 46 sailors are killed. I mean, it was a tragic event. But the United States hastily called together some of its allies, Britain, Australia, and for cover, I suspect, Sweden. And, you know, with South Korea, investigated it and blamed North Korea for sinking the ship with a torpedo. Chinese and Russian, you know, investigators did not come to the same conclusion, were not invited to join the, you know, the commission that conducted the investigation.
What did they find?
Well, there's a lot of ambiguity. I mean, that's why, for example, earlier this month in the United Nations Security Council, a resolution was adopted on the sinking of the ship, the South Korean ship, which condemned the sinking but didn't name the perpetrator. Right? I mean, because two...
Fishy business.
Well, two permanent members of the Security Council with veto rights, of course, are Russia and China, and they did not see it the way the U.S. has presented it. But what the U.S. has done is, used that as a pretext for was what were announced to be large-scale naval maneuvers in the Yellow Sea, which borders the two Koreas to the east, but China to the north and to the west. And they were going to move in the USS George Washington, which is a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, 20 other ships and so forth. It looks like the U.S. is relented about conducting that in the Yellow Sea. Instead, is moving it to the other side of the Korean Peninsula in the Sea of Japan, right off the coast of Russia. So, this is brinkmanship. It's almost gunboat diplomacy. It's I can only see it as being gratuitous provocation.
Did Russia and the other countries who came to a different conclusion about the sinking, was there any talk about, maybe unofficially off the record, just saying like, this could be another Gulf of Tonkin incident where...
Mm-hmm.
I know that's a key word sometimes, if a, false flag event, but...
No, that's a wonderful analogy, and I fear it already has been used, to some extent for that purpose, and,
mm-hmm.
Whether you taunt another country to send out a ship and then accuse it of doing something, who knows what the true nature of the sinking of the South Korean ship was.
As long as there's no witnesses, you could say anything you want.
I'm afraid.
What do you think the likelihood is that there'll be a new war over Korea?
Ooh, well, people with some degree of, and some history in observing international events, Fidel Castro comes to mind, a few weeks ago stated there'd be a very real possibility of a war, a regional war, and possibly a nuclear war.
It doesn't help the matter that North Korea is run by, for lack of a better term, screwballs.
Well, let us say decidedly untransparent. Let's use State Departmentese. a non-transparent government. So we don't really know what's going on there, either. And presumably also not terribly penetrable by our intelligence agents. But that's a good question. I mean, who knows?
And they're not shy about coming right out and saying, I have a report here from the Australian Broadcast Corporation, and they say. What was the quote here from Pyongyang? It says, prepared to launch what it calls a quote-unquote retaliatory sacred war.
Yeah.
And they say Kim Jong-il's regime says it will not hesitate to unleash its nuclear deterrent. Will not hesitate. Wow.
And it's impressing me on how well we've roped in so many Asian nations into our alliance. You say we have missile shield agreements with Japan, Taiwan, Korea and Australia. We've got troops from Singapore and Malaysia serving in Afghanistan.
Yeah, Mongolia.
And Mongolia. What would they care about?
There are only three countries that simultaneously border Russia and China. There are Mongolia, Kazakhstan, and North Korea. I mean, we may set the Korean Peninsula on flame very shortly. this is very serious for Russia or China. I mean, in Russia's case, they could have hundreds of thousands of Korean refugees fleeing into the country, and in China, millions.
Wow.
The last time we taunted North Korea, if you recall, within 3 months trying to enter the war. So, these are not things to be dismissed. But in Mongolia, the U.S. every year holds multinational military exercises, Khan, as in Genghis Khan, Quest. There's going to be one in August, which may be unprecedentedly large. And just recently, the president of Kazakhstan was in Washington, met with our President Obama, and immediately afterwards the U.S. announced that they were going to use the country to transport supposedly non-lethal military aid, but also troops, overflight rights over Kazakhstan for the war in Afghanistan. As a matter of fact, one National Security Council official talked about sending troops from Chicago, where I am, over the North Pole, honest to God. Over the North Pole, over Kazakhstan, and then, into Central Asia or South Asia for the Afghan War. So all three countries that, border China and Russia are increasingly being pulled into a U.S. military network. And, these can be used for other purposes, for military surveillance, for heaven knows what else.
What are these other countries getting out of it, the deal? What advantages is it to, say, a European nation like Germany to be involved in Afghanistan?
Boy, that's a good question. A lot of it is simply NATO requirements. you know, as much as they talk about being a, I think the formal title is a military alliance.
Being part
Democratic
of a club.
States, right?
Of, volunteer time.
I'm sorry?
It's like volunteer time. We'll join your
right.
club.
Yeah, yeah. Who wants to volunteer first? And but, you know, on the other hand, Germany is the second largest exporting country in the world now, I believe, next to China. It's a, it's become a major military exporter of military equipment around the world. Germany has the third largest contingent of troops in Afghanistan next to the United States and Britain. It has troops stationed in combat zones fighting, killing and dying for the first time since the fall of the Third Reich. It's had troops in the Balkans. It has troops in Djibouti, by the way, Ken, you know, since 2002 as part of a NATO operation. You know, warship stationed with NATO groups and so forth. I can't say that, you know, some of the major powers in Europe don't relish the chance of reestablishing themselves also, you know, their military presence.
Especially the French, I would think, who had such a big colonial presence in Africa.
Yeah, they, you know, the French community still takes in, you know, as many as 20 countries in Africa, and the British Commonwealth is many. So, you know, here's an opportunity for them to reestablish themselves after the, you know, tremendous anti-colonial drive following World War II. You know, ousted colonial powers who had, you know, exploited nations around the world for centuries. And, you know, I think it's worth noting that British troops are now, you know, back in Iraq, or were back in Iraq, or back in Afghanistan after losing three wars in that nation, being chased out all three times, and are back in countries like Sierra Leone and West Africa, a former colony. And that what's true for Britain is equally true to various degrees for France, Spain, Portugal, and the other European colonial powers.
Oh, my goodness. Is it just because certain people, I guess you could say the globalists, just can't give up the idea of dominance and just knowing that they rule somebody else? They just can't let it go? I mean,
yeah, I believe so. As a matter of fact, there was a revealing statement in an article jointly written by George Robertson, former NATO Secretary General from Scotland, mm-hmm. and Paddy Ashdown, you know, who was kind of the viceroy of Bosnia on behalf of the, you know, Europe for a while. And in, this is perhaps a year ago, and they said, you know, for the first time in the last 500 years, the West is confronted with a world that it doesn't control.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that statement, more than anything else, you know, doesn't control or is at risk of losing control of. And, you know, what's the new strategy for doing it? Well, global NATO comes to mind.
Well, there's that, there's strategy, but then you also have to have the manpower. And if you can't get your forces motivated to fight these days with professional armies, how do you go about doing it? And so they have to come up with reasons why they have to go there.
Yeah, and there's no, in very few countries in Europe is there popular support for, say, the war in Afghanistan.
So that's why the importance of these local forces like the Africa Standby Force. We get local people mm-hmm. to essentially fulfill our policy and give them arms and whatnot. I understand that's the new NATO trained group that we've got going in Africa.
That's a crucial point. That's a very important point. As a matter of fact, in an article I had written on the Africa Standby Brigades, you know, they we have NATO officials saying that they're based exactly on the NATO Rapid Response Forces. You know, the very same methodology. And the first test of the NATO Rapid Response Force was about 5 years ago off the coast of Africa in Cabo Verde, right, in Cape Verde. And it was a massive, you know, amphibious assault and you know, multi-service military. So, yeah, you're right. They're using proxy armies. Proxy armies in Somalia, proxy armies in Congo, you know, wherever else they need to deploy them. And they're being trained and, you know, they're being airlifted by the United States and NATO.
Because people, the average person, sorry, Ken, the average person doesn't recognize how many wars are going on all the time.
That's right.
You know, we've got a couple of major offensives going on, Afghanistan, Iraq, potentially. Then on the future, Iran and Korea, that is, you know, right around the bend, it seems. But there's
let's talk about South America. You know, the U.S. has been saber-rattling in Venezuela for the last 48 hours, letting it be known in no uncertain terms they're going to support the Uribe and the incoming Santos government in any military conflict with Venezuela.
You know, and the average person just could not care less about what goes on around the world.
Rick, I'm afraid we're coming to the end of this segment, but if you could briefly describe how you'd like to see American foreign policy changed.
We need to demilitarize. As you know, the Quadrennial Defense Review that was issued earlier this year, budgets, and you know, the both houses of Congress are accommodating enough budgets, $708 billion for military spending next year, for defense spending, which is the highest in current in inflation-adjusted dollars since 1946, which say the carryover from World War II. We need to demilitarize,
and that's not even counting supplemental budgets that'll end up being passed when that gets spent in July.
Well, what a republic, not an empire.
I mean, everyone calls for that, and in fact, that's the case. Look, you know, you don't hear it spoken of anymore, and it's a real tragedy. But, you know, maybe a year or 2 years ago you heard leading figures, including heads of state of nations like Russia and China, calling for global multipolarity, for a new global security structure. These are some of the code phrases they used. Unfortunately, you don't hear them any longer, but that's what you need. You need democracy between as well as within nations. Is another statement I think that needs to be looked at, and that we can't allow somebody to arrogate to themselves the right to be world sole military superpower,
right?
And dictate terms to anyone and antagonize, provoke people the way we've seen. Because you're right, there are other wars going on. You know, in the Philippines, there's a proxy counterinsurgency war we're involved with, in Yemen, in Somalia, in Mali. You know, in the western part of Africa, and there are several more of them to come, I fear. Right. Well, Mexico, maybe one.
Well, Rick, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I think it's opened a lot of our listeners' ears and eyes to what's really going on in U.S. foreign policy. So we'll hope to speak to you again.
Yeah, and I wish I could have been more focused, but there's
You were really helpful.
No, it's great.
Thanks a lot,
wait,
Rick.
Wait, Rick, where can we find your articles?
Oh, I see. Just type in Rick Rozoff, I guess, R-I-C-K-R-O-Z-O-F-F. And usually what comes up first is Stop NATO.
Also at globalresearch.ca.
Yeah,
there,
right.
There's a complete list of your articles.
Yeah, to his great credit, Michel Chosadovsky at Global Research in Canada has been good enough to post my articles. And I think that's probably how they get most exposure. So, yeah, either one would work. Or you could just type in, Rozoff Stop NATO, and you can get both the email list and the website.
And your articles are great. They're very well researched. They're very in-depth. It's like
getting a
master's degree in geopolitics.
Well, thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thanks,
Rick,
for joining us.
We'll speak to you soon, I hope.
Okay, I hope so, too.
Right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi, you're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and we're streaming at WPKN.org. We're coming up to about 13 minutes to 10. This is Ken McDermott Rowe and Gus Cantavero filling in for Scott Harris of Counterpoint. And we'd be happy to take your calls in the last few minutes until we sign off at 10. We hand off to Steve DeConstanza. So our number is 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. We'd like to hear your thoughts on any subject, whether it's on the ongoing wars, or if you want to go back to the subject of weather modification we're talking about before, or you want to talk about the economy, you would talk about Obama. The airwaves belong to you, so please feel free to give us a ring.
All right, we got our first caller. Go ahead, caller.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes, I wanted to speak about the leak over the weekend.
Absolutely.
The 90,000
WikiLeaks.
Right.
Go ahead.
And not so much what they contain. I mean, I'm not belittling that at all.
Uh-huh.
But the actual process of how did somebody get together and get 90,000 documents?
Well, it's not that he got together and actually went and pulled them out of file cabinets. They were leaks. They were sent to him by whistleblowers.
All right. Please, bear with me.
Okay, go ahead.
90,000 of them. All right? I mean, I know they've been, reduced to electronic form, but they still had to get out of the building. Somebody had to collate them, put them together.
Okay.
Even if it was a group of people doing it, and that is more to the point, was there a group of people involved in this? And to what end? Is it people that, are against the war inside the Pentagon? Or maybe, and we'll probably see this coming up in the next week. I mean, this is just a speculation on my part. This is what I'm going to say now. with the elections coming up for the midterm, maybe it's a smear job by letting out all this stuff.
Well, a whistleblower activity can be used for many different purposes. You know, it could be used as a way to support or a way to smear or undermine. You know, there's a lot of different motivations.
Caller, I've been wondering that myself. You know, why this is getting play. I was astonished to see Matt Waldman on CNN being interviewed by Wolf Blitzer about his report about the ISI's cooperation. That's Pakistan ISI's cooperation with the Afghan Taliban. And one suspicion I have is that a very important element in our leadership has decided this Afghan war is a mistake. There was a big article in Newsweek last week by Richard Haass, who's the president of the Council of Foreign Relations, which was very critical of the war policy in Afghanistan. He calls it quite a failure, and he wants a huge reduction in the war. So
that gets back to my opening point of how did this actually come about, the actual physicality of getting together. I mean, I'm sure there wasn't a file there in the Pentagon, which, you know, all Afghan stuff here.
I think it was uploaded electronically.
Well, so, from multiple sources. Yeah. You know, it wasn't just one person. It was hundreds and hundreds of sources.
Right. And how long would it take to, download 90,000 documents, put them on a flash drive or whatever?
Well, actually, not that long.
No.
If it's text, it's not that bad. I mean, you're talking about images, it's different, but the text wouldn't be that big a deal.
But you have to assemble the 90,000 documents, even if you're just...
I don't think it's that big a deal. I think if you just went to a directory and a hard drive and you said copy all of this stuff
and then sort through it later.
And that was that material was made available to the New York Times, to Der Spiegel, and to the Guardian.
Fellas, I understand that.
Weeks ago.
The security protocols inside the Pentagon, it just seems mind-boggling that all these things would be in one area to be accessed.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. There was an article last week in the Washington Post saying how the top secret world is totally out of control. I don't know if you saw that. It was a very long study that the Washington Post made.
Yeah. Right. And
they said...
close to 2,000 organizations.
Yeah, exactly, 2,000. And these guys don't know what they're doing. Yeah, so...
That's 2,000 separate places to get it from. This all must have come from one place. And that's why I'm saying...
That's a good question.
Real terror would be how it all got out. Not to say that it isn't important what got out.
And why is it being given such good play by the CNN and New York Times and very establishment institutions?
Oh, it's a great news story.
Well, they might repress it, but they haven't. They've gone with it.
I would thank you for your call.
Thanks for your call.
Well, yeah, I mean, he makes a good point. He wants to know why is it all being released now? Because, you know, WikiLeaks is something that's kind of underground. It's been
absolutely
made a scapegoat.
Yeah, the guy was on the run. I think the CIA was out to nail him a couple weeks ago, and now he's...
I mean, you and I talk about him. We think that there are different factions within the government who play against each other, and maybe this is one way of one faction trying to pin the other one to the ground, saying we need a different tact here.
There's definitely a falling out, because Richard Haass, and when we're talking the Council of Foreign Relations, we're not talking about pikers. I mean, these guys have supplied most of the secretaries of state, secretaries of defense, and secretaries of treasury. We have another caller?
Yep, this is a hot topic.
Great.
Go ahead, caller. You're live.
Hi. I wanted to mention something about...
Just kill your radio, please.
When you were talking earlier and asking why all this military effort and why we were going into other countries, I truly believe it is for the benefit of a global elite. I think it is absolutely only for business, for this 1% that are seeking to get the resources and to tie them up. And I think that they are definitely following a platform to lower the population in the world and to control people, to control the world.
So you think it's an idealistic end instead of just a corporate
profit
end?
No, I think it's a corporate business.
Caller, do you talk about this with your friends, and how do they respond?
I'm very well read on. I'm very up on things and very well read on this. It's very difficult to talk to other people about this because, I'm from Southport, and it's very difficult to find people who really want to talk about this sort of serious things.
Right. I mean, they'd rather just talk about fashion or football or...
Well, no, I don't hang with people like that, and I never have. it's very difficult to figure all this out. One has to be very well-read, and you have to pick points from different books, and then you connect dots. So it's like you can't take all your news from one source.
Right.
I find the best sources, quite frankly, are the books that are read on social policy, and of course, Link TV. And I do listen to Pacifica, and I listen to your station.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
I get a cross section, but I've also been part of, I don't want to identify myself, but I've been part of the global elite.
Okay.
And I have been listening all through the 80s. All I ever heard discussed was how the Bushes were going to get in. We were going to appoint a CEO president, meaning George W.,
mm-hmm.
and the big hurrah was all about revoking Glass-Steagall.
Yeah.
Right.
And which led to many of the economic problems that we have right now.
Well, what did finance want? To get rid of any regulation.
And now when you talk about the key man to revoke Glass-Steagall was Robert Rubin, who then leaves the administration of Clinton, goes with Citibank, makes over $100 million in his few years there, and then ends up vice chairman of the Council of Foreign Relations. So,
I mean, it's everybody patting everybody on the back, but it is the most frightening thing is the mindset that is out there. This is sheer greed at all costs.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us, Carla. We have to move on to another call, but we really appreciate you listening. I'm sorry. We lost our caller. But
Carla, call back.
We're coming to an end of the program very soon, and we thank all the listeners who called in tonight. We really appreciate your input.
There we go. Go ahead, Carla. You're live.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Yeah, I'm calling about this with the WikiLeaks guy.
Yeah, go ahead.
Julian Assange is his name.
Right.
Yes.
This man runs around the world with a knapsack and sleeps on people's couches.
Uh-huh.
This is a phony baloney operation.
Oh, really?
To either bring down the internet or to steer foreign policy.
But you actually think that he's fraudulent in his goals, though? You don't think that he's sincere?
Hired gun.
You think so?
Who would he be working for?
Him, huh?
Who would he be working for? Whose interest?
For lack of a better word, them.
we're all well aware of them.
he and this sophomore reporter from Rolling Stone, who brought down Stanley McChrystal.
Yeah.
I mean, if anybody believes that that reporter was able to bring down the top general in Afghanistan. He got fired because of this reporter. That's ridiculous.
Well, McChrystal did acknowledge that he made those statements and all that sort of stuff. It wasn't like it was illegally recorded or off the record stuff.
It wasn't. He didn't know he was. That's beside the point.
Oh.
The point is that the president is taking the word of this sophomore journalist from a music magazine to fire the top general. In a war.
Right, point taken. But at what point, and I'm well aware of, hold on a second. I just want to make one question to you. I'll give you one question. I'm well aware of the cross-pollination, let's say, of insiders working for an ulterior motive in trying to form and shape foreign policy and direct our government. Where would you be able to identify somebody who actually is altruistic and trying to do the right thing? Like what I do believe Julian Assange is legitimate. How would you identify somebody?
What do you know about Julian Assange?
Very little. All I know is that he's on the run from the CIA and he thinks his life is in danger.
Why would you call him legitimate?
Because he's bringing out secret documents that people otherwise would not be able to find, and it criminalizes the government. It shows that our foreign military operations...
Caller, you've raised some really interesting questions. I wish we could continue, but our time is at hand. Steve DeConstanza is coming in with Radio Base Camp. And thank you very much, caller, for coming in, for calling us, and all the callers that participated tonight, and all the listeners who joined us tonight. You're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut, and you're streaming at WPKN.org. This is Ken McDermott Rowe and Gus Cantavero of History Counts, filling in this week for Scott Harris of Counterpoint, who will be returning next week. Special thanks to our technical director, Dave Schwartz. And please join Dave, Gus, and me this coming Sunday at 10 p.m. here in WPKN for the next edition of History Counts, when we consider the possible role of the CIA in the assassination President Kennedy.
Thank you for joining us.
And please stay tuned for Steve DeCostanzo, host of Radio Basecamp, who is coming up next here on WPKN.
Bye, everybody.
Good night.